Portland.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, fighting the U.S. corporate extractors on indigenous land in prose and poetry. Also, an update on the continuing violent illegal Israeli seizure of Palestinian land in East Jerusalem and on the West Bank, and the racist dual standard at the U.S.-Mexico border. Ukrainians welcome, Haitians whipped, shackled, and deported. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network, coming out of San Francisco Live and Los Angeles Live these days. Good to have you along. And we do begin with the situation in Palestine. And we're going to tell you a special Berkeley event. We broadcast all over the world now, but this event that we're going to tell you about is very, very Berkeley. But first, joining us is Ziad Abbas. He is the program director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. That is one of my favorite organizations here in the Bay Area. They work with and they try and save the lives of children in the occupation in Palestine. And we're talking about the Gaza Strip, where it's hard to get clean water. Ziad Abbas, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Would you mind, sometimes they say comparison kills, but would you mind talking a little bit about the suffering that has been going on in terms of the Palestinian people? I mean, we all hate war and hate what's going on in terms of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But there's been an invasion going on now for about 50 years. Tell us, how are people being treated by the people who get the number one support in terms of U.S. government support, the Israelis? How are they treating the Palestinians?
Yeah, I know. It's a very hard time, even for the Palestinians, when they are watching what's going on in the world. First of all, we are MECCA, Middle East Children's Alliance. So our focus is to support and the fund and project for children. And as Howard Zinn, he said, that every war is a war against children. And when we think about the world, like whatever is happening, war, attacks, immigration, all this, it impacts children. It impacts everyone, but mostly children, especially in the young age. And for us, like watching that in Palestine and what's going on right now with Ukraine and how the hypocrisy and the double standard, the way how they treat refugees from Ukraine. And look at the people in Ukraine, how they present it in the media. I mean, at the mass media, which at the same time, they ignore what's going on, not just in Palestine or what's going on in Gaza. They're ignoring many other countries, which they are children and many people they are suffering for many, many years in the cases of Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Syria, and many other countries in different parts of the world. And you say, you try to compare. Yeah, it's very painful. First of all, myself, I'm a refugee and working with the refugees, mostly Palestinian and Syrian refugees in Lebanon and in Palestine. We understand what it means to be under attack. What we understand what it means for people that are leaving their houses, children leaving their childhood, uprooted actually from their houses and try to escape and to. We understand this very well. But to watch the world is using double standard, this is absolutely show that how the injustice in this world and how the discrimination and against other, especially refugees of other colors. And for Palestine, yeah, we are actually not 50 years. It's 74 years since 1948, Palestine, they are going, and before 1948, actually going through this kind of ethnic cleansing policy until today. And it's still the situation, nothing much changed, actually become more difficult and harder, especially when we speak about Gaza Strip under siege almost 17 years right now. And if you have a child there born 17 years ago, now almost 17 years old, never have been outside of Gaza. And Gaza, just 139 square miles, and you have 2.2 million people living in that small part. Yeah, they are struggling for still basic needs. The number of the people is under poverty increasing in Gaza Strip. Resources is very limited. Still, the people, they don't have the power. They have it between 4 hours to 6 hours a day. Water is still polluted, and still we are working in our project, building water systems in schools, try just to offer the children the access of clean water, because according to the many reports, including the Human Rights Watch report, around 26% of the young deaths in Gaza, it's related to the water pollution, and still it's killing the future of children in Gaza Strip. At the same time, it's a siege. The people, they stuck there. It's the biggest prison on earth right now in Gaza. The same in West Bank. It's not much better situation. It's still, you have the Israelis, the settlers, they are invading. Even today, they were attacking. I was reading the news just a few minutes ago, what happened in Nablus, how they attacked the cars, the Arabic cars passing near settlements where they are attacked. The lands attacked, uprooted trees. Settlers, they are protected by the Israeli army and attack Palestinian farmers everywhere. And they are in the checkpoints on the highways actually for Palestinians, the highways for the Israelis. But they are attacking the Palestinians in their own villages, not just when they are passed. In many villages around Ramallah, around Nablus area, and in Hebron area. And this is the fact they are speaking about. In other development, actually, which here just say something about it, the Palestinian political prisoners right now, they are, you speak about like almost 5,000 prisoners, political prisoners, they are preparing for open hunger strike. They are. The date is actually March 26th, and it will include all the prisoners and all the prisons, because the way how they are treated inside the prison by the Israeli government, including children, they are in prison, including women, they are preparing for this escalation actually against the violation of the prisoners' right and the way how they are treated, which you have prisoners for many years in isolation sections. And they are suffering a lot. At the same time, they are not allowed. Many of them, they are not allowed to receive any visits from their families, no contacts almost. And they are treating badly In addition to that, you have the administrative detention when they are refused to go to the Israeli army. And the administrative detention, they keep prisoners for many years. Every 6 months, they renew to them without showing any kind of evidence in the court. They call it the secret file. They present it to the military court, military judge, and the lawyer even not allowed to know what are the accusation. And they renew and keep people in the prison. So it's the same. The world in general, they are ignoring, except here where I, of course, appreciate as a Palestinian, there are the Solidarity Committee. They are still there. There are people like in solidarity with Palestine. They are still working and supporting the Palestinian. But the rest of the world, the general major, like the major media, how they are looking at the Palestine, we are not exist these days at all. And Palestine, it's in the bottom of the list. It's not among the priorities at all. Now the priority is for the Ukrainian, which I understand the people that are going through a hard time there. We refugees, we Palestinian general, we understand what it means to be a refugee, what it means to leave your house under the bombing and shooting. But at the same time, it's not fair to look at the world, how they are treated, treating the other refugees at the same time, treating the other people because their color or their background, who are they? They are treated in a different way, totally. Actually, they are not treated as a human being. And we saw what happened.
You know, I'm just thinking, Ziad, I'm just thinking that, you know, if you want to compare the situations, in the case of the Ukrainians, people are reaching out to those who are suffering. In the case of the oppression and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the U.S. is supporting the oppressing. When we talk about the Gaza Strip, and you call it, it's probably the largest open-air prison in the world, 2.2 million people locked down. So when the Israelis open up with some of the most sophisticated jets and bombing and drones provided in part by the United States, they're opening up on a people that who are captive, who don't even have the possibility of fleeing. So they don't have the right to become refugees again. And I remember, Ziad, last we spoke, there was a massive bombing going on of the Gaza Strip. They were hitting several buildings, 12, 14-story buildings. They knocked out the media center. But I remember you hooked me up with a family among hundreds and hundreds of families who were hiding in basements or whatever they could. And I remember the mom telling me that her daughter was shaking so hard she thought that her daughter would break her teeth. And that's not unusual, yeah. Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is when I say we understand the suffering. We understand because we are going through that. Not just in the past, we're still going through this. And I know, like, right now, I hear this story from our colleagues, our staff members in Gaza all the time. When the helicopters show up in the sky, many children, they run, try to hide under tables, and try to hide under something. The drones never leave Gaza sky. It's the same. It's there all the time. The tanks is surrounding Gaza, and every day, every night, there is some shooting, bombing around Gaza where it's wake up children at night. This is why we are doing some, like, specific project, try to deal with the with these children, how to reduce the impact, how they are traumatized, and try to reduce that on them. At the same time, try to help them to taste the childhood, to be treated as children, whatever we can do that, to support them. Yeah, absolutely. And here, when it comes to the, I speak about the victims. When the victims, they understand that, it's normal where you reach out to the people with experience, how they survive under siege, like. And in the case of Ukraine, this is the tragedy, actually, where the Ukrainian, they are reaching out to the victimizer, to the Israelis, to help them, to do something and support. They never reached out to the Palestinian to learn from them how to survive without power, like Gaza Strip, no electricity. How they survive, how they take care of their children, how they take care of their food. And these kind of details where it's very important for the people sometimes to learn from each other, like we learned Palestinian, we learned from many other people. They went through that before us in different kind of other, in Algeria, in Vietnam, in India, and many countries, including United States, during the civil rights struggle for the freedom here in United States. But with the Ukraine, it's different. The Ukraine right now, they count on CNN. They don't want the other victims like them. They prefer CNN. They prefer the other, like mass media. They prefer the Western countries. And yeah, they are. I can see how the borders is open. And it's sad to watch these children leaving their houses, leaving their schools, or they are hiding in basements. At the same time, it's killing you because there are tens of millions of other children, the rest of the world, no one pay attention for them. And this is why I call it the tragedy. Absolutely, anyone facing this all the time, we are in solidarity with anyone will be uprooted from their houses. Anyone, anywhere in this world, because we went through this. And especially when it comes some time to victims, they don't want to be a victimizer. But this is the tragedy, how politics sometimes, the dirty part of politics, and the double standard, the hypocrisy, the racism, how it's controlling in this world. I know for us, through our work right now, how we face this. Yeah, we supported a building, a two classroom in a school in Jordan Valley. Simply, the SLA destroyed the classroom for children in very marginalized communities. And right now we try to rebuild it again, to support the community to rebuild it again. But even when you come to the media here or try to publish something, no one pay attention. But we are watching, I'm watching the news, and I'm sad that it's happening for the people in Ukraine, but at the same time, I'm more sad that it's happened before and still happening for many other people in this world, including Palestine and Yemen, Libya, Iraq, and Syria, and no one is paying attention for that.
You know what's interesting, Ziad? A lot of the weaponry that the United States is helping to provide for the Ukrainians was tested by the Israelis on the Palestinians. You know, anybody who covered the endless killings of people who were protesting in Gaza, and it went into the thousands, understood that the Israelis were using the most modern weaponry, some of it coming right out of the United States, in terms of the kinds of bullets they were using that shredded the body, that made it impossible to put the body back together, invented in the United States, tested on the Palestinians, and now who knows, maybe the Israelis are on their way to the Ukrainians to use them again.
Yeah, it is. I know. For us, like watching how Israel, like right now, presenting themselves that they are receiving refugees. I'm not accurate about the numbers. I know some reports they spoke about 8,000 Ukrainian refugees, which mostly they are Jews, to 12,000 already in Israel. Where will they put these refugees? Are they going to be in the Palestinian land in the settlements? And this is the tragedy. Absolutely, these people, of course, need to be protected. Anyone under war, they have the right to be protected. But the idea, don't make them a victimizer. Don't put them in the settlement. And this is the tragedy when it comes some time to the how the opportunistic use this kind of war attack to oppress other people. Yeah, and for the Israelis, absolutely. If you see like how in a few days. And actually, there were many articles written about this. In 5 days, the first 5 days of the war, Ukrainian achieved what the Palestinian couldn't achieve in 74 years, including all these boycotts, the way how the international community come together against Russia, blah, 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 etc. Even the fever, the sports in the world, Russian teams, Russian players, they boycotted. Israel, they are oppressing the Palestinian since 1948 until now. Even the Palestinian, when there is a Palestinian, the Palestinian players, Palestinian sport activists, they are jailed, shot, and killed. And the international union for the FIBA, they will not do anything for Israel. Israel go the play. And even if other players, they are in solidarity with Palestine, they send them to the sport court and they fine them because they are in solidarity with Palestine. Look how it is in every now sport events, how they are raising like the Ukrainian flag in solidarity with the Ukraine, etc. But the other people, I'm not just here, just I want to speak about Palestine. Yeah, at the same for Yemen, at the same for Libya, for many other countries in the world, they are not presented or not, they are not acknowledged. Their suffering is not acknowledged by this international. And this is the hypocrisy. This is the double standard. This is the racism.
All right. Listen, we're running out of time. We've been speaking with Ziad Abbas, who is the program director for the Middle East Children's Alliance. And as you could imagine, listening to Ziad, they are engaged in some incredibly important life and death work and times just purifying the water in the Gaza Strip. And so you have a wonderful, we broadcast around the world now, Ziad. We're also live in Los Angeles. We're happy about that. But this event that you are part of, this fundraiser for the amazing Middle East Children's Alliance, which we also call Mecca, is quite extraordinary. You all are celebrating. It's a tribute to Gus Newport, the former wonderful, eclectic, global mayor of Berkeley, Gus Newport. We loved him a lot. We love him a lot. You all are celebrating him with special guests such as Danny Glover and Angela Davis and Bernie Sanders, Holly Neer, and the list goes on. And the inevitable, amazing Barbara Lubin will be there. And so,
yeah,
it's an event. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it is an event. I'm just want to remind the people. This is an in-person event for the people around the Bay Area. You can come to the event, but just you need to be vaccinated, and you need to show the card of your vaccination and booster too. For the people, wherever you are, you still can join the event, because this is an in-person event and virtual event. Just you can go to our Mecca website. Yeah, it will be virtual live. And of course, I want to remind the people, Gus Newport will be there in person. Danny Cleaver will be in there in person. And many others, Bernie Sanders will be virtually. Angela Davis will be virtually. And many others, Halle Neer will
be there. What a crew, Ziad. That's a crew.
Yeah, they are amazing, amazing. And I just want to remind the people for here, just you go to our website. And this event will be here in Berkeley. It will be Monday, March 28th at 6 p.m. in person and virtual, and it will be in the Fried and Salvage Coffee House here in Berkeley. And go to our website, www.meccaforpeace.org, and you go to the event, you can reach out, the tickets, they are available, and we want the people to come to honor amazing, amazing, amazing leader, contributor.
And that's Mecca, so that's Mecca with one C, so it's, this is a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance, that's Mecca. With one C, check them out. It's going to be both virtual, and for those of you listening in the Bay Area, it's happening at the amazing Freight and Salvage. That's sort of a place where souls gather to experience some extraordinary events. And so if you can make it, if you're healthy, if you got your card and you shot, show up. Or show up virtually and know that when you...
I just want to remind the people too,
yes,
Dennis, that Gus is he's the former mayor. He's the head of... He used to be the head of our board for over 30 years. He's among the founders, like the board founders with Barbara Lubin and Howard Levine. They are the founders of Mecca. But Gus...
And this is one courageous guy, Ziad. This is what, because he even had a turn trying to manage KPFA. So Gus Newport is a courageous fellow. But again, this is happening on March 28th. There's in-person and virtual. Mecca is with one C, M-E-C-A, if you want to Google them and check it out that way. And Ziad, we always appreciate the important information and want to thank you. I'm remembering now, if I'm not mistaken, forgive me for reminiscing this way, but I remember I met you live on the radio when you were socked away hiding with a bunch of kids and you were singing Against the Fear because you were under fire by the Israelis. Am I remembering this correctly?
Yeah, you are remembering this quickly. It was 2001, Beit Sahur town and the second intifada in Palestine, and we called live. And we were stuck in one of the houses and the shooting, and we stuck there for hours. And what I will do with the children, And the children, they were scared. We were stuck in one corner. We were worried they will bomb the house. And we start singing and playing games. Yeah, they are shaking. I was shaking too with them, but I tried just to kill the atmosphere, and we started playing and singing. I remember that. And this is like 2001.
I was shaking 6,000 miles away. And I think it was then you were given the Robert Kennedy Peace Award, right?
No, I'm not taking any award. I don't need any award. I need the people to come to the event for Gus's event.
All right. March, well, you got 20th,
Monday.
You got my.
Go to McDowell's side. They can donate for the children of Palestine. This is the most important part. And they can join us in the event. Don't forget that. This is the time to honor our leaders, and especially someone like Gus Newport. And thank you, Dennis.
Okay. Be safe, Ziad. Be safe.
You too. Thank you. Take care. Bye bye. Bye.
All right. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We cover it all. We're going to take a short musical break. When we come back, we're going to go to the U.S.-Mexico border, and we're going to talk more about the treatment of Haitians and the dual standard that is now blazing and emblazoned on the minds of those black people who are being rejected, as the Ukrainians, as they should be, are being welcomed in and being offered a pretty good deal compared to the Haitians. Stay with us. We are trying to reach our senior producer, Kevin Pina. Kevin, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me, Dennis?
I can hear you. Just speak up nicely. We had a little technical problem there, but yeah, Kevin, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks. Well, you know, the internet is full of technical problems because of the large amount of hackings. There are innumerable sites you can go to today that send you to one of those special sites that say not available now. This site is possibly dangerous. Anyway, we're here.
All right. I'm glad to have you. Let's start with, we've been hearing horrific reports about the treatment, the different treatment you get if you're white Ukrainian versus a black Haitian. You want to give us, like, I know you've been monitoring the situation and massive deportations of Haitians.
Or if you were an interpreter, Afghanistan interpreter who worked for the CIA or the U.S. military, you are open, you're welcomed here with open arms. But if you were the victim of U.S. foreign policy and your democracy was destroyed and your sovereignty was destroyed, as was done in Haiti, and you're black, you get whipped on horseback by INS and Homeland Security. That's the difference. You don't get welcomed with open arms. You get driven away. You get deported back. There are now thousands of Haitians who not only, you know, have taken circuitous routes now. The main route is to Colombia, believe it or not. Long journeys to Colombia, but also now to Puerto Rico. We're seeing large boats showing up on Puerto Rican shores. We're seeing boats now going to the Keys in Florida, to popular tourist destinations now, and unloading. So many Haitians are in such a desperate situation because their country was destroyed by U.S. foreign policy. And as you said, rightfully, they are not treated the same way if they are Ukrainians. They're not treated the same way if they were interpreters who worked for the CIA or the U.S. military in Afghanistan or in Iraq. They are pariah, despite the fact that their homeland was destroyed as a direct result of U.S. foreign policy, as a direct result of the U.S. backing a coup that directly destroyed their democratic institutions, and then, of course, led to a 13-year military occupation by the United Nations. It's shameful. The hypocrisy is shameful.
Amazing. We're speaking with Kevin Pina, and we're talking about really profound hypocrisy, and so we've got these flights that are continuing, Kevin, to chain people in by the hundreds and force them back into Haiti. Has the situation gotten any better in Haiti, or in fact is it easier for the oppression to take place now that everybody's focused on Ukraine?
Well, let's just put it this way, that one of the main actors who the U.S. supported to overthrow Haitian democracy in 2004, Guy Philippe, who is now being held in a security prison in the U.S., is now being allowed by U.S. officials to give daily interviews to the media in order to influence the political outcome in his country. No, nothing's changed. The role of my government, our government, in destroying Haiti's democratic institutions, basically what we might call a modern invasion, not an invasion with tanks and guns, but let's also remember that when you support a proxy army to destroy a democratically elected government, it wasn't Haitians who controlled Haiti when U.S. Marines took Jean-Bertrand Aristide and put him on a plane and flew him to the Central African Republic on February 29, 2004. It wasn't Haitians who controlled the tarmac of the airport. It wasn't Haitians who controlled all the major security centers and the police in Haiti. It was the U.S. Special Forces who led that invasion on the ground. It was an invasion, and it was military. Remember that when they threw out democracy in Haiti, and by the way, it wasn't just Aristide, it was 7,500 elected officials who were purged from that democratically elected government in that coup, February 29, 2004. It was a complete overturning of the order of Haitian society, and we're seeing the result of that today. But remember, it was the U.S. Marines who controlled that country, and when there was resistance in the streets, there were thousands of people who took to the streets to protest directly against the U.S. Marines. Those images were never shown in the U.S. press, in the European press, in the international media. The media was silent about the resistance to the U.S. taking over a democratically elected government, to destroying it and taking over the country of Haiti. The U.S. media didn't scream or cry about Haitian resistance and how we need to support their democratic aspirations against a tyrant, a tyranny of another government. The media was largely silent, but that's exactly what happened, and we can draw a straight line from that coup to the horrific conditions that exist in Haiti today, where gangs control two-thirds of the capital, where the Haitian police, who were trained and armed by the United States government, became drug dealers and the leaders of gangs, where billions of dollars invested of U.S. taxpayer money went straight down the toilet to so-called rebuild democratic institutions. Today, Haiti is a narco state. Today, Haiti is a country that's run by gangs with an illegitimate government that does not have the respect of its own people. And yet, when Haitians try to flee that hell that was created by another government to impose a tyranny upon them, to destroy their democratic order, Haitians are met with whips, Haitians are met with boats, Haitians are met with guns, Haitians are put unceremoniously back onto planes by Homeland Security, by the INS, and they are sent back to that living hell that our government has created for them. And it's a travesty of justice. And for anybody to cry about Ukraine and not see how hypocritical that is, I don't know what I can do for you to convince you that there are no good guys here. This is not about some World War II scenario of a great resistance, you know, against the tyrant of Russia, when in fact we have acted like the tyrant of Latin America and the Caribbean since the Monroe Doctrine, and certainly in the contemporary history of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Wow. That's Kevin Pina, senior producer here at Flashpoints, which you hear over Pacifica Radio every weekday from 5 to 6. And our senior producer here, Kevin Pina, has spent many years in Haiti. You failed to mention, Kevin, the fact that it was also with the U.S. support that the United Nations brought in cholera. They created the cholera epidemic in Haiti. Am I wrong?
No, they brought it in for sure. Nepalese troops, and then they tried to deny it. And then when Haitians protested in the streets, the United Nations gunned them down in Cap-Haïtien, Haiti's second largest city. That's how their demonstrations and protests were met, when they were calling the truth to power in Haiti. And what did the U.S. press say? They covered it up. What did the European press say? They covered it up.
What, when we were talking once, I was talking to you when you were on the ground in Haiti, where you spent many years, you had the UN troops threatening to shoot you, pointing their guns at you. Why would they be pointing their guns at a journalist who's live to the United States?
Well, actually, what they did was they threatened to arrest me and turn me over to the Haitian police, which is probably worse than being shot and killed in the streets during that time, because it was a Haitian police that wore black masks. It was a Haitian police that arrested and tortured Catholic priests. It was a Haitian police that was armed and trained by the United States and the so-called international community. And it really what it was I was calling, again, pulling off the veil of the narrative of the United Nations reputation for as do-gooders, when in fact what they were doing was supporting the consolidation of a U.S.-sponsored coup that led to the disruption, the murder, the rape, and in many cases the torture and summary execution of Haitians in their homes and in the streets of the capital and many of the major cities throughout the country. And whenever you told that truth, they didn't like it. That was when they threatened me, and they threatened to arrest me and turn me over to the Haitian police.
Well, Kevin, your kids are half Haitian. How do you talk to them about Haiti and what's going on? how do you share history with them? Did they know who Aristide is, what he stood for in the context of his people?
Well, I don't think you have to explain to Haitians who Aristide is or their own history at all. You know, I have a radio show every Saturday on RadioCajou.com. That's the only bilingual program in the world that addresses weekly updates of the situation in Haiti. And Haitians know what's going on. It's the majority who are trying to flee that country. It's untenable. I can't describe to people. If you heard the worst description of life and bombings in Ukraine by the Russians, it would pale in comparison to the daily kidnappings and murders in the capital of Port-au-Prince. It's the kind of life, it's the living dead for many of them. That's how they've described it to me. We are alive, but we're not living. You can't consider that a normal kind of life and imagine raising children in that environment or trying to raise children when you can't leave your home to shop without fearing somebody kidnapping you or threatening you with a gun. And then if you complain about it, you have nobody to call. You are completely on your own. The Haitian population has been left to be preyed upon by gangs. Gangs that were created by a Haitian government that was backed by the United States through two administrations. And those gangs today, they prey on the population openly. There is no real center of a state and security apparatus in Haiti that represents the Haitian people. But there hasn't been that in the country since 2004. This has been going on for nearly, two decades now. This is a situation where now an entire generation has been lost to conditions that we would consider intolerable in this country, that no one would ever expect any human being to accept. And yet, when Haitians try to flee, when they legitimately try to leave that hell that our policies have created, they are treated like pariah, they are criminalized, and they are unceremoniously shipped back to that hell.
You know, Kevin, it's also politicians and movie stars that made hay, for instance, on the earthquake in Haiti. How many people did that earthquake kill? And you have folks like Sean Penn and the Clinton Foundation sort of making hay and money at the same time.
Well, you know, and my advice to, you know, those folks who think they're doing do-gooder stuff in Ukraine and giving money to, I mean, you should see the plethora of organizations that are popping up to do relief in Ukraine. Well, we saw them around Haiti, too. And we also know that more than $7 billion was ostensibly raised, the Clinton said, and Biden took the saying to build back better. And we also know that the majority of that never changed the conditions, the fundamental conditions that Haitians are forced to live under today. It was not invested in infrastructure. It was not, if they'd given it directly to the people of Haiti, it would have been better than the way that it was siphoned and absconded, even by international organizations like the Red Cross. Yes, even the Red Cross. And yes, organizations like Sean Penn's, where of course he ended up rubbing elbows with Martelly, and it's Martelly's PHTK party that led us to this current hell that exists in Haiti today. A party, political party that was put into power by a direct intervention of Hillary Rodham Clinton, then Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, which then built gangs in order to impose its will upon the Haitian people, the very thing they had accused Jean-Bertrand Aristide of and Lavalas of doing, which of course wasn't true, became their own self-fulfilling prophecy, their own way of doing business, leading to the conditions that exist in that country today. And you can draw a straight line from the U.S. sponsoring those organizations that overthrew democracy in 2004 to the conditions that exist in Haiti today.
Well, a U.S.-supported coup, and they did it on leap year, so you wouldn't have an anniversary for the coup. Very smart thinking.
Every 7 years.
We're gonna have to leave it right there, Kevin. We've been speaking with Kevin Pina. He's the senior producer at Flashpoints here on Pacifica Radio. We're always glad to have you, Kevin. The information is extraordinary. I know there's a lot of people out there who are angry with me, who are doubting that this is all true. But folks, it is all true. I've been there myself too. I've seen this firsthand. Kevin, thanks so much. Please stay safe and give those kids a hug for me, will you?
Sure will. Thanks, Dennis.
All right, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about resisting the extractors in indigenous communities around this country, both in prose and poetry. Stay with us. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We have a first-time guest. We are welcoming Mark K. Tilson. He's an Oglala Lakota, a poet educator from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. He comes from activist families long steeped in the struggle of liberation for all people and the long-term survival of the Lakota Nation. At Standing Rock, he stepped into the role of direct action trainer and police liaison. Since then, he has led trainings and teach-ins about the lessons learned from Standing Rock. Mark Tilson, also a wonderful poet, has a new book. We're going to talk about that, too. Mark, welcome to the Flashpoints.
Thank you very much. An honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you with us. And what did you learn at Standing Rock? What did people learn?
Oh, we learned so many things. One of the biggest walkaways that I try to get people to understand is that direct action is the key component of every frontline resistance movement, all of this extractive industry. Like, there's so many ways, and wherever you are in your life, there's a way for you to contribute to the movement. Like, it's not just people locking down to equipment and getting arrests and disrupting construction, but like, and anytime there's these resistance camps, like, you know, we need cooks, we need child care, we need security, we need people who are really, really good at building community together. We also need folks to, like, how do we manage with people who are coming, who are already really traumatized and are often re-traumatized by these conflicts that we're having with, you know, police and mercenaries and security forces and sometimes the workers themselves.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the situation now. There was a bit of a victory back in the Standing Rock after the Standing Rock resistance, but a lot has gone on, and now Big Oil is, if you will, turning the screws and open up the pipelines. How can you can't live without us, and all those laws are disappearing. So you think the extractors are feeling re-empowered?
Definitely. And also, you're seeing it at the pump, and you're seeing it in their profits, and they kind of have decided that they recognize that they are the primary cause of catastrophic climate change, of man-made climate change, and they have no plans on stopping anytime soon.
Go on.
We've recently found out that Exxon Corporation has had scientific data all the way back into the late 60s, early 70s, about CO2 emissions leading to temperature rise. And so they've known about this and had their own scientists verify it. And we are now seeing, rather terrifyingly, even under the Biden administration, leveling the charges of eco-terrorism for people who resist the pipeline. And
right.
It seems like, there's not a ton of terrible competition in the oil industry. They all use the same subcontractors. They hire the same lobbyists, sometimes even the same legal groups. In the case of the Dakota Access Pipeline, there's this shell company that they can create called a mastered limited partnership, where they can team up and join together on projects. So these folks, what they're doing is every time they're having a victory where they get one of these pipelines successfully built, they take the learnings and the education that they've gone there and then bring it to the next location. And sometimes that means hiring a PR firm that knows how to target and attack water protectors on social media, how to do doxing, how to do that kind of work. And sometimes it means literally hiring the sheriffs from the other fights to come down and give a presentation and train their officers on how to handle water protectors. And we saw that in Louisiana. It's interesting though, these corporations are basically buying off the local police force to do their own, to do their work for them.
Wow.
And to protect their pipelines.
That's an interesting fact. Listen, Mark, I know that you have a new book of poems, and that's close to my heart because it's poetry that keeps me alive. Whatever happened in this world from about 4 to 8 in the morning, I'm sitting with looking at a blank sheet and praying that something will come. I know you've got a book. It's called It Ain't Over Until We're Smoking Cigars on the Drill Pad. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
You want to read a poem or two?
Yeah. I'll just tell you a little background on the title.
Yes.
Very flippantly, a journalist asked us, after December 5th came down and the president had the Army Corps of Engineers revoke DAPL's license to drill under the Missouri River. One of the journalists asked me, "Are you going home?" I was like, "It ain't over till we're smoking cigars on the drill pad," and that was the title. Yeah, that's just the title I came up with.
Excellent.
I usually try to start off with this love poem.
Okay.
I met you at Standing Rock. The phrase said so often it loses meaning, but let's imagine it's true under the night of the fireworks. Some false victory when the cynics asked, "What are you celebrating?" A boy met a girl, a young woman and a young man to be more precise. He wore his freshest baseball cap at a jaunty angle. Don't know how he kept that basketball jersey so crisp for weeks in camp. And she was a vision, all defined jaw and high cheekbones, caramel skin, skin tight, flashy shirt and white jeans. Her hair so long she could sit on it. He holds up two cell phones playing the same music video. She twirls round and around, hair spraying out like a silky galaxy, hitting his face all slow motion car wash. He blinks, the lights of the phones flashing over her as she smiles in the twirling dance, hands held low at her sides, palms flat to the earth and still green grass. It is an Indian summer that will last forever. Fireworks ring them in iridescent halos of explosions. She will smell of wood smoke, camp food, choke cherry lotion and conditioner from the Prairie Nights Casino. Maybe not forever, but just for this moment, he is in love with this girl, this time, this place. When I tell my sister Lee in the morning what I saw, she asked me, did this really happen or was it a dream? This was before the water cannons and rubber bullets, snipers and mercenaries, helicopter flyovers, Humvees and AMRAPs. Before the broken bones, batons and mace, I look up at the godless sky. Both, I tell her.
Really nice, my brother. That's Mark Tilson reading from his book, It Ain't Over Until We're Smoking Cigars on the Drill Pad. That is exquisite. I'm thinking that that's a poem definitely about love, but I'm thinking all poems are love poems because they've got to come from some transcendent part of the heart, right?
Yeah, I think when you sit down with the whole of my book, there's a lot of sadness, there's a lot of heartbreak in it, and we have to kind of remember those golden moments of true random beauty that came like sneaking out of nowhere. And because I think it's, we have to do something to uplift our spirits, because this work is intergenerational and it's really difficult.
It's really difficult. Well, read us another love poem.
This is a super short one.
Okay.
Camp Life.
We like short ones.
Yeah. Camp Life. It's not that we were free, not really, but on a clear day, we could see what freedom looked like.
Mm-hmm. I love the definition of poetry as sort of confirming the unverifiable facts, you know, that go along with love and fear and all that stuff. It's about how to make something beautiful. Keep going. We got a couple of minutes.
Yeah. What I really like about what that camp life is, like, if you were at Standing Rock, you know what I was talking about. And in the strangest of all places is like money became less meaningful. It became almost like an object. We can't buy anything here. There's nothing to buy.
Was talking about money in Standing Rock. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny is that, like, there's people who that ended up becoming a real confusion and focus. You know, like, it was never really about that. We didn't come there to get rich. We didn't go there to be poor. We came up there to fight a pipeline, and we found community. We lived in teepees, and when it got too cold, we got yurts, and we lived in the army tent. And, there was this really interesting invention called the tarpy. Yeah. Those were it was just like a vinyl wrapped 2x4 teepee kind of frame. Standing Rock.
Get one in for us because we're running out of time. 3 minutes. All right. Go.
All right. Let me try to find another poem.
Okay. I'll say you're listening to Poetry on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Mark Tilson. He's got a new book of poems. He's an indigenous activist resisting pipelines. And in his spare time, I'm sure he has a lot of it. It Ain't Over Until We're Smoking Cigars on the Drill Pad, his latest book of poems.
This one's called Water Protector. It is best said in a Boston accent, Water Protector. It's not aesthetically pleasing, a trite label, a shortcut to thinking. Some government workers adopted it, thought they meant they weren't protesting and could keep their jobs. Some wrapped themselves in the spiritual glamour, but all it really means is I showed up. I tried in my way. Our cars are old enough to be in college. There's always a duct tape look to them. We run our vehicles down just like our bodies. It's rare, but some of us are healthy. But healing? I don't think I've seen it. Our gear is the entire range of mountain climber gifted Arctic pants with matching jacket to factory moutlet mall orange coats, free box fresh, that donation tent couture. We smoke like chimneys, cigars, cigarettes, weed, mountain smoking, something strange with chamomile. Home rolls are the norms. You know you're hanging out with water protectors because none of us drink any of it. Red Bull, coffee, tea, soda pop, Gatorade, whiskey, and Kratom. The food we cook is everything in between, organic, gluten-free chickpeas to dumpster-dive packaged meat. smoked salmon, and roadkill salvage. The most carb-loaded feet and armory for a dollar. You can tell I was raised poor dinners. Always a baseball bat in the trunk, but no gloves or a ball. Yes, we have weekend warriors, those vacation in the movement, day trippers. And we have family that are so everywhere, you can't keep track of them. Which camp or continent or cause they're at, always fighting. Been in camp so long, the idea of home is gone. Some of us don't sleep soundly. The sounds of helicopters wake us. Are we sleep too much, missing the adrenaline rush of another riot line and that addictive feeling of purpose that maybe the fate of the world depends on what we do here? We pray every day for the water, for the children. Our resistance is ceremony. Dear God, let my friends live through the night. Let them get out of jail. And finally, dear God, if tomorrow is it and you and I will be meeting shortly, let me not embarrass myself. Let me do right by the ones that brought me here. Let me be fearless just one more time.
Beautiful. Thank you. This is Flashpoints. That's Mark Tilson, and we're gone.
Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz.
The group made serious demands for 5 institutions to be established on Alcatraz. And why don't we have them yet? A Center for Native American Studies, an American Indian Spiritual Center, an Indian Center of Ecology that would do scientific research on reversing pollution of water and air. A great Indian training school that would run a restaurant, provide job training, market indigenous arts, and teach the, quote, noble and tragic events of Indian history, including the Trail of Tears and the Massacre of Wounded Knee. And a memorial, a reminder that the island had been established as a prison initially to incarcerate and execute California Indian
resistors. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements.